Okay, folks, you're listening to Planet Porky. I want to thank you very much indeed for tuning in. Got Lord Snooter with me today, and I have to say, Sam, we get some very good responses to the last couple of podcasts that we've done together. People like our take on rock stars, dying young, and, you know, are you going to live forever, and all that kind of stuff. And I know you've had some particularly interesting responses, have you not?
Well, yes. I mean, I am truly shocked by the attitudes of some of the Planet Porky listeners.
Yeah, well, I think
They are fundamentally flawed, I think. I think they quite like the idea of indulgence and perhaps a little bit of overindulgence and maybe a little bit of hedonism as well. And, well, you know, obviously there's a fair few hippies out there among the Planet Porky tribe.
Fair few hippies, okay. Well, everybody's welcome to join Planet Porky, jump in those rockets, folks, switch those engines on, get on to Planet Porky. A story that caught my eye, Sam, right, and I still can't work this one out. There's got to be something dodgy about this. Did you see the bloke who is a musician? Who has a violin worth £250,000?
Oh yeah,
I mean it's like an antique.
Is it a Stradivarius?
Really. It's not a Stradivarius. Funnily enough, I thought it would be. I think Stradivarius are worth millions of pounds.
Are they?
Right?
Are they?
So this
is some kind of cheap imitation, then, is
well,
it?
Well, not a cheap imitation. This guy plays with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Right?
Oh yeah,
he's got this fantastic 310-year-old instrument. 310-year-old instrument.
Oh, blimey, that's pretty ancient.
Imagine playing a guitar that's 310 years old.
Yeah, that is crazy, isn't it?
I don't think they had guitars 310 years ago.
No, I think you'd have been playing something like
a
lute. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, or something like that. But anyway, I'm trying to find out what this guy's is called. Let me see. He says I'm a... Anyway, the point of my story is this thing is worth £250,000. It's his working instrument.
Right.
And he gets off a train and leaves it in the luggage rack.
I mean, how can you possibly forget about that?
I mean, this is what I can't figure out. What is going on here? Musician has appealed for the return of his £250,000 antique violin after leaving it on a train. He'll get it back. He must do, because, I mean, it's such a... But how can you work that out? How can a man be so stupid? I mean, he's supposed to be one of the brightest people in Britain. He plays with the Royal Philharmonica, OK? But... I just don't understand it.
Well, I mean, it is pretty remarkable. I've heard about people leaving their musical instruments in restaurants before where they've actually got up and I don't know why you'd have a musical instrument in a restaurant unless you were playing it there, you know, as a part of the sort of the
evening. You might be coming home from work.
Or possibly home from work or whatever it might be, or maybe at the end of a performance, perhaps.
Yeah.
And I've heard about that before. But leaving it on a train is quite something. I mean, I know that sometimes you can have a sort of brain fart and forget about, you know, what you're doing. But how you would get into a situation where you've got something that's worth £250,000 and leave it behind. I mean, I suppose the only thing he can hope is that people don't look at that and think, oh, that must be £250,000 violin there. They just think, oh, there's a musical instrument. I better hand that in to somebody because it obviously belongs to somebody. But if anyone thinks that's got any wealth to it, there's no way he's going to get it back.
No,
chance.
There's chances, aren't there, who would say, oh, that's a musical instrument. Take it off the train. Go and find out what it's like. By the way, I found out what it was. It was a 1709 violin, was one of only a few made by the German master craftsman David Techler, okay?
All right, okay.
And this guy, whose name is Steve Moss, had been due to play it while leading the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra in two concerts with Italian opera singer Andrea Bocelli.
Wow.
How on
amazing.
Earth could you leave your instrument of work? I mean, it's like a blinking footballer leaving his boots on the train, isn't it? You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Now, Andrea Bocelli, of course, was the singer who you may remember, Mike, sang at the Leicester City title-winning celebration all that time ago, a couple of years ago, when they won the Premier League.
Did he?
But he's also blind. So
he's blind?
So perhaps the violinist could turn up and just pretend to play the violin and he wouldn't notice. So maybe that's an advantage, perhaps.
Well, maybe. Who knows? But anyway, look, in the course of time, I hope he gets it back. He says, I'm just the custodian of it. I'll tell you a good story. Andy Townsend, very good friend of mine, and of course, distinguished footballer, won the League Cup twice with Villa and was captain of Ireland on the day they beat Italy in the World Cup in America. Do you remember?
Yes.
In the US.
World Cup USA 94. Remember it well. Ray Houghton scored.
That's right, he did. Yeah, fantastic goal, didn't he? Yeah, I've talked to Ray about that many times. When Ray has a few beers down him, he tells you, you know, all the details of that day and what they did in the evenings and all that kind of stuff. You know, Jack Charlton and all that kind of stuff. Brilliant. But anyway, the point of my story is that one big fan of Aston Villa was that celebrity violinist.
Oh, yes. Nigel Kennedy.
Nigel Kennedy, thank you very much indeed. And Nigel Kennedy, of course, is a sort of faux Mockney, isn't he?
Yes, he is a little bit, isn't he?
Yeah. This guy's giving me attitude. You know, some guy here telling me to put my violin down, give me attitude, I'll give him attitude. And all that kind of stuff. He wants to be a working man, doesn't he?
Right.
But he got on the Aston Villa plane going somewhere. I suppose it must have been in Europe, you know, after they'd won the League Cup or something that. And for a bit of a laugh, or they thought it was a laugh, one of the players decided to nick his violin.
Oh, for goodness sake, right, okay.
And
yeah.
That was a £1 million Stradivarius, And it nearly, I mean, he nearly had a nervous breakdown. You know what I mean? I mean,
you know, as you would. Yeah,
yeah, exactly, yeah. But you know what footballers are like. I mean, footballers think everything's funny. Footballers think it's funny to, you know, break into your room and take all the furniture out.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely, yeah.
And all that kind of stuff. Or put super glue in the lock of your car at the training ground or something like that. Or, in fact, I remember on one occasion at Liverpool's training ground, who was it who turned up with a new car? One of the younger players turned up with a new car. It might have been Steve McManaman or something. And Razor Ruddock decides a bit of a laugh. I thought it was quite funny. Razor told me this story. They took the driving seat out of his car. So can you imagine? You know, I don't know how they did it. They must have called a bloke from a garage. You know what I mean? And said, you know, so if McManaman turned up in his new car and it was, say, for instance, a Jaguar or something like that, you know, or Range Rover, I bet they rang the local Range Rover and said, send somebody around here, you know. I bet they gave him £100 and they'll take the car, you know.
Wouldn't they have had to have unlocked the car first as well to get the seat out?
Well, presumably if he was from a local garage or something, they'd have, maybe they don't lock the cars in the
possibly,
you know,
not
the training ground car park or whatever, you know.
Maybe
what
had the keys, got the keys from
got
somewhere,
the keys
who knows.
Off in the training ground,
I love
like
the
that.
Fact that footballers don't really care about costs. No. They'll do whatever it takes to get a good laugh.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So they took the driving seat. Now imagine trying to drive a car without a driving seat. I mean, how would you do it? Just stand or
you'd be standing, wouldn't you? It'd be a bit like, I don't know, I suppose being a train driver, you'd be standing up.
Absolutely. But anyway, listen, I know a good story about training grounds and footballers. I had a friend, still have a friend, who's a Chelsea footballer, retired now, you know. And when Chelsea got their new training ground at Cobham, one of the things they had to have it insured, obviously, brand new, Mr. Abramovich had built it, all that kind of stuff. So the guy from the insurance company comes round, and the most surprising instruction he gave to them was that we can't insure this place unless every single player in your squad has a singularly and properly identified safe, which we must inspect before insure it, because the value of their watches was so huge.
Oh, really?
It was so huge. Like, you know, John Terry or, you know, Joe Cole or somebody might have had a watch worth £50,000.
Yeah.
And this guy from the insurance company was walking through a training. Imagine you and I, when we were at school, you know, getting changed in the changing room, you know. Where would you put your watch, you know, in your sock or something like that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And this guy, he said he saw millions of pounds worth of watches just lying on the table in the front of the changing room.
That's the other thing with footballers, and the main reason why they don't mind about cost when it comes to practical jokes is because they actually don't have any idea of wealth, do they? Particularly nowadays, really. Leaving a £50,000 watch lying around somewhere would not be anything to them, really, would it? You know, they wouldn't think twice about it.
It wouldn't. I totally agree. And in fact, when you see that footballers in their early 20s, I've seen this quite recently, turning up for training in a Rolls Royce.
Oh, yeah.
And some of them can cost £300,000.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
It's always a source of irritation, isn't it, to people a little bit?
Well,
not necessarily the other players.
It's not just a source of irritation. It's an indication that that person has completely lost the idea of wealth.
Yes, without doubt. Yeah. And lost touch with reality, really, haven't they?
Near to where my family lived down in Surrey, I was driving down there and I took a kind of circuitous route quite recently because they were doing some roadworks on the main road. So I went into the rather very plush housing, not estate, but a, you know, group of houses. And I passed one on the right, which an awful lot of work was being done to. and there were cranes there and all sorts of things. And it is being rebuilt for old Tammy, what's his name, of Chelsea.
Oh, Tammy Abraham.
Tammy Abraham. Because I stopped and, you know, I have the curiosity of a newsman, you know, curiosity of a journalist that you have as well.
Or somebody jealous about seeing a huge house that you couldn't quite
afford.
Well,
I knew it was probably a footballer because a lot of footballers live around there.
Right.
A lot of the Fulham team live around there.
Oh, yeah.
Chris Coleman used to live there, you know, the Fulham manager and all that kind of stuff. You know. So I just stopped and said hi. I, fortunately, one of the builders, because I could tell you, you know, F off, you know, it's nothing to do with you, knew me from TalkSport. And I was just, I mean, I didn't know him. I just stopped and I said, hi, guys. I said, so is that another 21-year-old footballer, is it? He said, yeah, matter of fact, it is. It's Tammy Abraham, you know. So I don't want to tell people where it is for obvious reasons, but he's having it rebuilt. It's costing millions of pounds and he's 21.
Sure.
And isn't his brother playing for, is his brother playing for Fulham, is it, or something? Hasn't he got a brother who plays as well?
I'm just trying to think.
Yeah, I think he may do. I think he has. But anyway, look, point of the story is they do awfully well. Now, talking about footballers, okay? My attention was drawn to something else I've seen because obviously I keep an eye on things that are going on. Do you remember Franny Jeffers?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now,
famously signed by Arsene Wenger, wasn't he, from Everton?
For £8 million.
Yeah, to be
fox
the sort of fox in the box. Yeah,
that
absolutely.
Was described.
Absolutely.
And it's an interesting story. Now, the reason I raise this is because there was a report of Franny Jeffers having to answer to a court quite recently about a domestic situation.
Right, okay.
So we'll leave that aside.
Yeah.
It involved him and his wife. It's a domestic. It got to court. Franny and his wife can sort that out. I wish them the best of luck and hope it all sorts itself out. However, it did remind me of the, you know, Franny Jeffers' antecedents. So in 2002... I think it was 2002. My memory's gone. It might be 2003, but it's February anyway. West Ham, England are playing. I think it's Holland, wasn't it? Who do they play? Anyway, the point of the story
I think
is
it might have been Australia.
Australia. Ham, well done. Well done. Well done. Australia. I should have remembered that. It was definitely Australia, and it was one of those nights when Sven, you know, brought the wrath of the football world down on his shoulders by changing the whole team at half time.
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So this was so at half time he changed all 11 players, and leading the England team were Francis Jeffers of Everton and Wayne Rooney of Everton.
Oh yes.
So Everton had a double spearhead leading England, you know, for the first time ever, two of the youngest players on the pitch, and England lost 3-1.
Yes, that's absolutely right.
And the one goal scored for England was Francis Jeffers.
Right.
Right. But Francis Jeffers then became one of these legendary footballers with the history of England record, played one, won one, scored one.
Yes.
Perfect England record, you know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah.
He was never picked again. I don't think he ever got into the squad again. And unfortunately, Franny had, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to accuse him of anything he's not got, but maybe he had a challenging attitude to authority, okay?
Right, right, right.
Yeah, yeah okay. So... So, in a minute, we'll compare how Wayne Rooney's career went with Franny. But Franny sort of went back to Everton after that, thought he'd become a superstar. His agent got involved, demanded a move. Everton in those days were mid-table club, I suppose, something
yeah.
like that. We had no money in those days, you know. Mr. Kenwright battled, you know.
That would have been under Walter Smith, I'm guessing, at that time.
Yeah,
possibly
that's right.
When
yeah.
David Moyes came in. The
yeah.
point of
no, Davy came in about, you're absolutely right, about 2002-03.
Yeah.
Because in his second season, 2004, we got into fourth place and got into the qualifiers for the Champions League. But you're absolutely right. You've got it all right. In fact, Davy might have been there already because he wouldn't start Wayne in the England, in the Everton team
oh, yeah.
all the time.
Yeah.
He said it was too much pressure on him. I used to argue that, yeah, but you bring him on at 75 minutes when we're 1-0 down.
Yeah,
that's even more pressure on
him.
Yeah, you know, go on, son, go on and win the game for us and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, the point about Franny Jeffers is a lot of hassling went on. I think the Everton management decided he was, you know, too much trouble. Arsenal put an offer in for £8 million. Arsene Wenger took him, as you quite rightly say, fox in the box. Didn't work. He then went round a string of clubs. I can't remember all of them, but one of them was Blackburn. Mark Hughes was manager at Blackburn. And Franny Hughes and his agent went in and said to Mark Hughes, we want to double his money. This was in his, like, third season or something, or second season. Mark Hughes looked at Franny Jeffers' record. He'd only started three games for them. He had a fitness record. He had a fitness problem. He'd been out of form. He'd been substituted. And it was ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
A couple of years after that, another guy who we worked with, a footballer who had a place in Portugal, suddenly announced that Franny Jeffers had bought a big villa next to his, despite the fact he was playing very little Premier League football. Mm. And footballers weren't getting the huge fortunes in those days they get these days, but they were still getting tons and tons of money.
Yeah.
And Franny was getting loads
five figures
of money.
A week, wasn't it, generally speaking?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. And his career never revived. Wayne Rooney, on the other hand, of course, went on to become England's record scorer, has a personal fortune of $160 million, according to the latest US rich list.
Not bad, is it?
Has a £5 million house in Barbados, has just built a £20 million house in Cheshire, you know, is without doubt one of the most famous footballers now in the world because of his experiences in America. But that was it for Franny. And it just... You know, and again, it's a sliding doors moment, yeah. Really. Maybe if Franny had stayed at Everton, maybe it would have worked out for him. Lots of footballers go too soon and their career then gets stultified by the amount of opposition they run into at their new club.
Without any question. And in fact, there's another one. Jolyon Lescott may even be another one who Everton players yep. who kind of moved on perhaps a little bit yes. too soon or were keen to get out and it yes. never quite kicked on from there. I mean, yep. Lescott was a bit older, but certainly Jack yes. Rodwell's a great example, somebody who ended up yeah. Completely and utterly kind yes. of treading water at Sunderland, yeah. Yeah, among yeah. other clubs. Yeah. And of course, we saw him on that documentary, that Netflix series, where he was talking about not leaving the club despite the fact that he was on something yeah. like £20,000 a week because yeah. he'd been on that money since Sunderland were in the Premier League.
That's
and then
right.
he was there in League One.
That's right.
Just wanted to keep the same money.
Yeah.
Didn't have the same motivation, but wanted the same money, you know. Mm. And yeah. and it is amazing. Like you say, the sliding doors moments. And it's, what I think is particularly interesting, Mike, is yeah. that people sometimes accuse Wayne Rooney of perhaps not quite living up to, and I'm not saying for one second, I'm not just yeah. for one second he didn't have a very, very good career, he did. But yes. people say, well, look at, for example, the trajectory of someone like Cristiano Ronaldo. Yeah. Wayne Rooney didn't quite live up to those heights.
No.
But the more you realise about other players of his generation yes. and that sort of stuff, and yes. some of the players you've just mentioned, and many, many, many others,
yeah.
you realise that actually Wayne Rooney had an absolutely phenomenal career that most players
utterly,
can only dream of.
Utterly phenomenal. And when he got to America, he tried as hard as he's ever tried, and he was revered there. That's all over now. Supposed to be coming back to Derby. We'll see how that works out. Now, we ain't got a lot of time left, Sam, but we need to... listen, let me tell you what I'm going to talk about next. OK, folks, you're listening to Planet Porky. Thank you for joining us today. With Lord Snooty, of course. And thank you for all your responses, for all the podcasts. And I hope this one finds you, as we find you, a great set of listeners. Now, we've had two full weekends of fireworks, Sam, okay? Because obviously November the 5th has come and gone.
Yeah.
And because it happened midweek, you get the weekend before and the weekend after. What do you think about this nonsense that some supermarkets like Sainsbury's decided not to sell fireworks this year because it's injurious to pets? What do you think about that? Have you got a dog?
I don't have a dog, but I do have a couple of cats, I'm afraid.
Oh, you've got
to
a couple of cats,
yeah,
right.
Of cats.
Right.
And
so how did they react?
Well, they're not very fond of fireworks, to be honest. And of course, the problem
now
with...
did you deal with it on the nights when the fireworks were blazing above your house?
This is the problem, you see, because the cats aren't necessarily aware that it is the 5th of November or any other date anywhere yeah. near that sort of time.
Yeah.
And therefore, they don't necessarily expect it. It's not like with humans right. when we know it's coming up and you can prepare for it and all the rest of it.
Right.
So with cats or those people who have dogs, I know that it causes dogs great stress because they hear the loud bangs and they kind of yeah. get a bit freaked out by it and all the rest of it. And I must admit, it is a source of frustration in our house because...
No, but that's the dog's fault. Well, that's the dog's fault, in my view.
How could it be the dog's fault?
Well, listen, we don't change the world, you know, on any other issue, just to suit pets, because we are, you know, we're Homo sapiens. We're superior to animals, right? We're superior to all animals. We're not that much superior to apes and monkeys, but or elephants. But we're very superior to a daft dog whose intelligence level will never attain more than that of an 18-month-old human being.
Well, I mean,
right?
certainly we're more advanced, aren't we, than most
advanced,
animals. But
yeah.
I think yeah, everyone...
You can speak as well.
I think that all animals deserve the same level of respect, do they not?
Of course they do. They deserve respect, but I'm not going to change the whole of the world lifestyle and all that just to suit animals. Well, it doesn't work that way.
No.
You know, this is not Planet of the Apes, you know what I mean?
But here's my problem with fireworks, okay? So yeah. I'm actually quite fond of fireworks. I very much enjoy the film V for Vendetta. I quite like to see them in the sky. I like to see them, for example, we have fantastic views, don't we, in our offices at TalkSport
of
the fireworks on New Year's Eve, for
example.
Right. They're absolutely tremendous over the Thames and all the rest of it. But the problem I have with them is, why the bloody hell are people doing them for you know, basically the spell of a week? Why don't they just stick to the night that they're supposed to be on? Why are they doing them the week before, the week after, all the rest of it?
Well, because the world gets wealthier and wealthier, and I mean, for instance...
What are they celebrating when it's not on the night itself?
No, they're like watching fireworks go up in the sky.
No, it's a waste of time, you ask me.
Well,
complete waste of time.
Well, I have to say, I'm not a huge fan of fireworks. I can watch a firework display for about 3 minutes, and then all the oohing and aahing, to me, just dissipates, because it all looks the same, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So I don't mind seeing that. But what I'm saying is... You know, particularly for children, they love firework displays, okay?
Yeah.
And the idea that Sainsbury's, one of the leading retailers in this country, said, no, we're not going to sell any more, fireworks to save pets. That's nonsense. Children love firework displays. We all love firework displays if we're celebrating something right. One time down at my place in Gosport, right, which is on the other side of Portsmouth Harbour, a ship came back, you know, from a long mission and all that, and they had a firework display.
Mm-hmm.
It was brilliant. It was beautiful. And it was to celebrate that. Now, what are they supposed to say? We will not celebrate the achievements of the Royal Navy because it'll upset a dog in Gosport. That's mad. What you've got to do is... If you're a responsible pet owner, right, and I'm talking to all your responsible pet owners out there, get some earplugs for your dog. That's what you can do.
Well, some dogs have got quite floppy ears. I mean, how do you put earmuffs?
Well,
the earmuffs
find one.
On,
you
something?
Know, it's not beyond the wit of man, is it? You know, to invent an earplug for a dog. I bet you I could. You just put a big bag over... If it's a spaniel with big floppy ears, just put a bag over its ears, okay?
Right, okay. So you're going to put bags over the dog's ears, are
yes,
you?
Yes. I would do something like that because I just think it's mad, excuse me, to have our lives... dictated by pets. Anyway.
I must admit, I will say, I do think it's a bit ridiculous to stop selling them on because of the pets.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to stop selling them because there's been a surge in firework-related problems, for example, that one's gone off into people's hands, or there's people having issues with sparklers or can't control themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually think that there's too much protection on people these days and too much nanny state, too much molly coddling. Let people get on with it. If they have problems, that's their own fault. You know, don't stop them doing what they want to do. But and I certainly think that not selling them fireworks because of the fact that they might upset the pets is a bit of a nonsense, really. But I'm also on the other side thinking that people are overindulged with the old fireworks stakes. So perhaps it's maybe for the best.
You've got to make your mind up on this one, Sam. Honestly, you can't, on the one hand, on the other. You've got to be more firm.
Well, my firmness comes with the fact that I don't think that they should stop selling the fireworks for the sake of the pets. I think that is a complete nonsense. What I'm saying is that maybe it's for the best that they do it anyway, because I think people take the piss with it, to be honest.
Well, it's a big industry anyway. People live in it. What do you think about being assailed by a sign in your local pub in August about book your Christmas lunch here?
Well, I mean, to be honest, they kind of...
I think it's good business.
They have to, don't they? I mean, a lot of the time, why not get out there as early as you possibly can?
Absolutely.
Announce the fact that you're open for business, announce the fact that you're around on... I mean, I think... Do pubs actually open on Christmas Day specifically?
Yes.
A lot of them do now, don't they?
A lot of them open at lunchtime and then close at sort of 2 o'clock.
I've always quite liked the idea of having a Christmas lunch at a pub. I mean, I've never actually done it because a lot of the time it's family, you spend it with family, don't you? But I think quite take the pressure off the family by having it at the pubs is quite a nice idea. But
I don't like
the idea of the pub being completely and utterly overwhelmed and rammed with people on Christmas Day, which I'm no doubt it would
be. What I like is I go to a local pub in Surrey, Stockbroker Belt and all that.
Wetherspoons?
No, there aren't any Wetherspoons in this part of Stockbroker Belt.
Oh, right. Okay.
And you mix with the locals in their wellies and their woolly hat, having a Christmas morning drink. And it's lovely. The atmosphere is great. Everybody's in a good mood.
I thought you hated people in wellies, you were saying on a recent podcast.
Well, only if they're farmers.
Right.
And they're trying to attract tasty women, who should really be looking, smoothies like me.
Oh, I see.
But we walk over the fields to the pub, that's right, and then walk back for the Christmas lunch. However, this year... I arranged for the family to take the family to a hotel because sadly we lost our mum last year, and mum was too old and frail to really join us at a hotel for Christmas. We thought we would. And then the usual thing happened. Some members of the family didn't want to do it and some did. And bang, that got blown out the water, okay? But I do like the old Christmas Day thing. But as for people moaning, and I banned this as a story when I was working in newspapers. I said, that's not a story. Somebody comes and say, it's August, the sun's shining, people are still on holiday, I've seen the sign, book your Christmas. I said, no, that's good business. If people didn't start advertising until December, A, nobody would book, and B, the businesses would collapse. So I've got nothing to worry about with that. Do you think that we're giving too much respect to too many young people in the world? It started with Greta Thunberg.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It started with Greta Thunberg. And now the world is being shaped. Now, the other thing is, of course, we're in election mode now.
Absolutely.
Right. What about the ridiculous idea of giving 16-year-olds the vote? What do you think about that?
Well, I think what's interesting is that there's a minimum age, isn't there, for voting, but there isn't a maximum age. I mean, are you telling me that 16-year-olds have got, you know, that they aren't have got any kind of influence when it comes to, for example, people who are 90 or 100 who can vote? I mean, people who are 90 or 100 who are voting are not going to be around really to know the result of their vote, and yet people who are 16 have got to face it for not just the next 4 or 5 years, yeah, but for the rest of their lives.
I think that's a load of bollocksios.
Right.
My view is that people who get to 90 have lived a life. They've experienced what it takes to get through life. They know the good and the bad elements of life, and they know the good and bad about low taxes or high taxes, about an economy that seeks to be capitalist or centrally government-based. They know about high spending and low spending. 16-year-olds know nothing. If a 16-year-old got the vote, to start off with, and they lived in a country area, they couldn't vote unless their parents gave them a lift to the polling station.
That's true.
That is ludicrous. The other thing is, every 16-year-old I know still has their mobile telephone bill paid for by their parents. So if you're not responsible for your own life and for standing on your own 2 feet, earning your own money, you know, self-sufficiency, how can you possibly go around and vote on how the country should be run?
But do you not think that it would only be those who are informed enough who would vote? Like, for example, I mean, but the thing is, I mean, you'll get people in their 30s and 40s who aren't really informed but still vote. So, I mean, what difference does it make if they're 16 or whether
they're
45?
Because when you're 16, you're impressionable. So any politician who comes along and says, oh, you know, I'm going to give all 16-year-olds a national wage, you know, of £30 a month. Because that mad ideas like that,
sure,
come. Politicians come to that, you know, give every 16-year-old a £30. They're so impressionable. And also, you know, mad politicians who go around saying, let's ban the bomb. 16-year-olds think that's a pretty good idea to ban the bomb.
Sure.
Right? Now, we know, because we're adults, that the bomb isn't there to go and bomb anybody. The bomb is there to stop people bombing us. But they haven't, the 16-year-olds haven't acquired that political philosophy or that reality yet.
So, I mean, the opinion polls say, don't they, and this is broadening it out a little bit, but yep, the opinion polls often suggest, and I read one recently, of course, as you correctly say, we're in election or electioneering type territory, yep, now, and a lot of the opinion polls, yep, suggest that when you're a sort of late teenager, you know, first point you can vote, so 18, yeah, up to about, I think it's up to about 34, the recent opinion polls I see.
That, right.
Traditionally speaking, you're looking at a large swathe, a massive proportion of Labour voters. And,
yeah,
as you get to 35 plus, it's a much larger proportion of Conservative voters.
Right, okay.
So, I mean, are you basically saying that anyone under the age of 35 is effectively ill-informed, or because they're changing their allegiance as they go along? Or
no,
is it just people who are kind of in their teenage years that haven't got the right idea?
I think the older you get, the more realistic you become about life. And that is why, in every generation, we all have warmth and affection for our grandparents. They're seen to be wise. They're seen to be caring.
And they not seem to be outdated at times as well, though, and not really necessarily evolving with the times.
It depends how you clarify outdating. It depends how, you know, you think that... I mean, the ludicrous idea that nobody over 70 should vote. Are you blinking mad? Some, you know, people who are achievers in life go on to much, much greater ages than that. Some of our industrialists are still working at a terrific pace at the age of 75.
Sure.
At the age of 80, even. Bernie Eccleston, right, billionaire, you know, the man who invented Formula One as it is today.
Yeah.
He's in his 80s and he's,
yep,
still working every day.
Yep.
Are you telling me that that man who generates billions of pounds pays hundreds of millions of pounds in tax? In fact, he's due, I read, to pay £1 billion tax bill. Are you telling me that he doesn't deserve to have the vote, even though he's contributing so much to this country? Are you telling me that?
No.
Are you, snowflake?
Absolutely not. But what I am saying is he really aware of how the world is now compared to how the world was when he was growing up and he was 18, 19, 20?
I think he knows more about it. because of the experience of life that he's had. I call it the gas bill syndrome, okay? If you haven't got a gas bill, you believe that the world owes you a living and that it should be full of nice people and that nasty politicians, you know, shouldn't go around having budgets on things like the National Health Service and shouldn't spend money on things like defence because you're impressionable. But once you get a gas bill and you realise, ah, now where am I going to find the money to pay this gas bill? I haven't got any money because that politician has taken it all off me in tax and he's wasting it all on some stupid idea like building HS2, a railway nobody wants. See what I mean?
Mm.
And I think the older you get, the less impressionable you get. That's my view of life.
I don't disagree with that, actually, because I do think that there's an element of the things you don't get taught at school, as in, you know, adult problems, like, for example, having a mortgage or paying bills or finding where your next, as I say, like bill or whatever it might be is coming from, where you've got to pay your next rent or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
All problems that you face as an adult, but you don't face those as a child. You certainly don't face them at 16. I mean, you might be facing them when you're maybe 18 and moving out or 21 and moving out or whatever.
Mm.
And I think you need to have a certain worldly wiseness to be able to really assess where the world is.
Yeah.
Because when I was growing up, I kind of had an impression of, you know, you hear from what your parents say, what your grandparents say about how the world is. But it's only when the problems are really, you're really facing the problems themselves that you know what you're actually dealing with and what you're actually voting for.
I totally agree. And I agree with you about schools as well. You know, too much time. Why do people teach children Latin anymore? Okay, so you go to a top school like Harrow or Eton or something like that. I mean, their parents can afford to give them life skills outside of school. But why aren't children taught how to drive cars at school?
Yeah.
Why aren't
they budgeting?
Budgeting. You're right about mortgages. Suppose they get the wrong mortgage when they're too young.
Yeah.
You know, it's
so easy to do that.
It's a payment only mortgage.
Yeah.
You know, sort of trap you're getting yourself into and these blinking mortgages where you save and save and save for years, you end up with 10 grand after 30 years.
Yeah.
You know, you need to be taught about those sort of things. But you also need to be taught about, you're absolutely right. I mean, relationships you need to be taught about because you're so impressionable at that age. You know what I mean? And you know, you need to be taught about not being conned and all kinds of things like that. But I totally agree. The other thing I think that we should do is revise the university system, stop teaching children things that don't matter and teach them how to lay bricks and drive lorries because we have a shortage in this country. Right. OK, Lord Snooty, thank you very much again. Excuse me, the old air conditioning's got me in the studio here. I want to say to everybody else, thanks for listening. And Sam, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Where can people get a hold of us if they want to let us know what they're thinking? What's our Gmail address?
Yes, so you can email planetporkypod@gmail.com. We will, or Mike will eventually get back to you when he remembers to check the inbox. But
From time to time,
you'll have a little get back and correspond with some of you.
It's a bit difficult. My Twitter handle, folks, is at Mike Parry 8, and Sam, yours is?
I'm at Sam Stevens 71, even though you don't follow me on Twitter yet, Mike. You're welcome to out
do
there.
Do I not?
No, you don't. No.
Is that right?
No, that's absolutely
true.
Do you
know, I didn't know that. Do you know, lots of people say that to me, and I didn't realise you have to press that blue, like,
yeah, just press the follow button.
The follow, that's right. Yeah. And funny enough, Piers Morgan asked me why I hadn't been following him. Yeah. He's got like
the man you look up to in world.
He's got 6.7 million followers. You know, whenever I see somebody, you know, who I admired for years, and I'm working with them on TV or something like that, they'll say, "Well, of course you don't follow me." And I think, there we go. I mean, I never chose to follow President Donald Trump, but I get all his stuff. Why is that?
Well, you must follow him.
But you see, I don't understand that. Some people I don't follow, and then a very important announcement's put out on Twitter, and all of a sudden I've got it, like Liam Gallagher. I don't follow Liam Gallagher, but I see his most extraordinary. Is it because somebody else retweets it?
Could be that, yeah. It could be that somebody that you follow. I mean, how do you follow anybody if you don't know how to follow somebody?
Well, my nephew,
right,
who I see, you know, about every 6 months, I say, and he puts me onto all the Everton sites to follow. So on match day, I get a regular updating of scores and all that. And he generally does all that for me, you know. I follow our colleagues in the newspapers and all that kind of stuff. But no, you're right. It's something I must pay attention to. As always, Lord Snooty, many thanks, and we'll be back. He got on the Aston Villa plane going somewhere. I suppose it must have been in Europe, you know, after they'd won the League Cup or something that. And for a bit of a laugh, or they thought it was a laugh, one of the players decided to nick his violin.
Oh, for goodness sake, right, okay.
And
yeah.
That was a million-pound Stradivarius, oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it nearly, I mean, he nearly had a nervous breakdown. You know what I mean? I mean, you know,
as you would.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah. My Twitter handle, folks, is at Mike Parry 8, and Sam, yours is?
I'm at SamStevens71, even though you don't follow me on Twitter yet, Mike. You're welcome to out
do
there.
I not, do I not?
No, you don't. No.
Is that
no,
right?
Yeah, that's absolutely
do you know,
true.
I didn't know that. Do you know, lots of people say that to me, and I didn't realise you have to press that blue, like...
Yeah, so press
blue.
The follow button.
The follow, enough. That's right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and funny enough, Piers Morgan asked me if I hadn't been following
don't
him.
Piers.
Yeah. He's got like
the man
six...
you look up to in world. Even
he's got 6.7 million followers. You know, whenever I see somebody, you know, who I, you know, admired for years, and I'm working with them on TV or something like that, they will say, "Well, of course you don't follow me," and I think, "You know, I." We're superior to all animals. We're not that much superior to apes and monkeys. But or elephants, but we're very superior to a daft dog.